I'm tempted to not tell you my personal story of being the object of hate. And I don't need to recount it all, but maybe it's enough to say that when you take a position that's not popular, and when people that oppose not only your position, but eventually you as a person, and even the God that your position represents, it's not a pleasant time. You start to wonder, what is it? How come, God? Dorothy Sayers once complained after her horse threw her and she landed in a mud puddle and was heading actually to a place to minister to some people. And she thought in disgust as she cried out, God, why do you do this? I'm one of your friends. No wonder you have so few. You know, and, you know, I mean, she complained probably for all of us in some measure. You know, God, why? How come this is happening? And especially when you can't really trace a clear path to a deserved sort of outcome. You're going through something that just doesn't seem to fit, and you scratch your head and wonder, why is this? You didn't do anything to deserve it. It's totally unprovoked, and you're still hated. You're still strongly loathed by people. In fact, not just a few, maybe your enemies outnumber you greatly. You ever had that experience? You could try to laugh your way through it. I remember Swindoll said one time, friends come and go, but enemies accumulate. You know, and it's a little chuckle, but that doesn't lift your spirit for very long. You could flee. Laughter doesn't work. Maybe you could run from it. You can, you know, try to get away from it. Like a school-aged friend of mine did. He was hated. I grew up with this boy. We were both boys in the Bay Area, and he was hated for no other reason than he was born with a birth defect. And he was mercilessly teased until finally he couldn't take it and wouldn't take it anymore, and he committed four horrible crimes. And they lost the key. He's never going to see freedom again. You could, but that won't work, just as it didn't work for my buddy. Now imagine that your enemies exist only because you're a God guy or a gal. You could give it a more formal name, but you belong to God. It's not a secret, nor would you want to make it a secret, but you belong to God. And let's call you a prophet or a prophetess. You stand out from the crowd, and as a man or woman of God, people don't like you because we live in a godless world. So, you know, people choose darkness rather than light. Wasn't that what Jesus said in John 3? So you, if you feel that way from time to time at your job or at school, I know we're in the summer, but think back or think forward. And people know you to be a Christ follower, a friend of Jesus, and they don't like it. They don't like you. Maybe you feel a little bit that way from time to time. Then you would be a little bit like and may have coffee someday with Elijah. He'd be a good guy to check in with when we finally get home. Because Elijah was the one that said, God, I don't get this. Look, we just did some serious damage to this godless Baal, and we wiped out these horrible false prophets, and now this terrible woman, Jezebel, and her henchmen are after me. They say by sunset, I'm a dead man. That's a terrible, lonely feeling. Remember he said, there's no one left, just me. And then God's wonderful words were, no, you're not really alone. There's thousands. Jesus said to his disciples when he sent them out, remember this? You will be hated by all on account of my name. Oof. Did I brush over that when I was first told about Jesus? Did that point never get clarified in seminary? Or Jesus went on to say in John 15, if the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. Now, you and I hear that, and probably with me, you get that. Don't like it, but you get that. You understand because Jesus predicted that. But what happens, let's take it a step further, and then we're going to jump into Psalm 3. What happens when the person that has no time for you, the person that, I don't mean literally time, they can't deal with you, can't handle you, have no respect for you. They hate you. They have hate in their heart toward you. What happens if that person is a family member? I'm not digging a hole here to make you feel bad. I'm digging to help you connect with something that's very real in the Bible. Maybe it's a spouse. Maybe it's a child. Maybe it's a parent that's written you off, or a sibling. I know now I'm describing a game changer. You can handle the hate that's in those other places I describe, but when it's flesh and blood, it's a game changer. Today, my Bible's open to Psalm 3. If yours isn't already, would you find your way to page 384 in the Bible that's tucked in a chair rack near you, to this third song or psalm in the 150 book collection of songs. And we encounter in this song just such a situation. It's the first of 13 ascribed to David, where its superscription, that means the identifying words or descriptive sentence or two before the song, actually describes the situation in which David found himself when he wrote it. There are 13 such songs out of the 150, and this one tells us a song or a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Okay, so it's the first song that actually identifies this is where these words came from. All right, we'll get to that in just a sec. I want to point out one other feature of this psalm. It's the first psalm where the word Selah, see that? It repeats three times. The word Selah occurs. It means to pause for the purpose of punctuating a point. How's that for alliteration? By the way, today I'm trying monovision, so my right eye is working really well distance. So if I look at you sometime, my left eye works for the close-up, so I may do a little of this from time to time, and I don't mean to be awkward about it, you know, but anyway. So, Selah. There's a point that you'll get and appreciate more deeply if you pause. That's the idea here. And there's three of them in this song. It's meant to be with three. It carries the idea of emphatic. What's being said is forceful. It's not subtle. Okay? So that's what's Selah. Notice three here, meaning there's an intensity going on. Now, what is the setting of this psalm? Well, the superscription tells us he was fleeing from his son Absalom. Absalom had committed a revenge crime against a half-brother Amnon, who had committed a sexual crime against Absalom's full sister Tamar. You can read the details of it in 2 Chronicles chapters 14 to 18. Please do, because there's some very graphic and very troubling details that will help you appreciate the depth of Psalm or Psalm 3. According to the narrative of that 2 Samuel 14 to 18. According to that historical narrative, this coup that was led by Absalom was a complete surprise to David. So much so that we're told in 2 Samuel 15, verse 30, that David fled the city barefoot and weeping. Didn't have time to get his sandals, and was brokenhearted. Can you picture the scene? He's the king, and he's running for his life from none other than his rebellious, hate-driven son, Absalom. There's a whole lot of other work we could do with regard to the fact that Absalom, when he committed this crime of revenge against Amnon, you on the surface could say, well, he gave Amnon what he deserved for the terrible things he did to Tamar, and that's all true. But because it was a crime of revenge, the Old Testament law required some kind of justice. What did David do, who was sitting on the throne? What did David do? I'll show you what David did. Don't bother me with such things. He didn't want to hear about it. He didn't want to see and know the details. He wanted it to go away. And instead of it going away, eventually it led to this terrible coup attempt. Imagine such a scene of shame and humiliation for King David. Hunted by his son like a fugitive. I mean, picture this. We've said this before, but David's not just some schmuck that comes along and calls himself king. He is a man after God's own heart. And by the way, that descriptive label of David was not done by his contemporaries. You realize that that label came centuries later in the New Testament in Acts chapter 13, verse 22, I believe. Meaning throughout the ages, all the news and information, every piece of fact by then had surfaced, and he was still understood to be a man after God's own heart. Sometimes we'll say celebrated things about somebody that's a hero right now, but when it's all said and done, millennia later, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, he's a man after God's own heart, says Acts 13, 22, and he's running for his life. So in this psalm, written on the run, David details his plight and his desperate need for God to do the things that last song presented, to be the deliverer. Let's look on and read Psalm 3, verse 1. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. Selah. As you might imagine, David, first of all, felt incredibly abandoned and or outnumbered by his enemies. That's why he says three times, many are my foes. Many are rising up against me. Many are, probably the most painful part of those opening words, many are saying of me, you're on your own. Not even God is going to help you. You know that spot. You see the numbers and they're against you. But then somebody suggests what you're trying to kind of ignore, the sound of in your ear that, God's, where's God? Maybe he doesn't care about this situation. Well, they're leaving no doubt. Many are saying, in fact, God will not deliver you. You will not be able to count on him for help or for deliverance. You know what we're reading about in the opening two verses of Psalm 3? We're reading about a supersized dose of discouragement. I mean, talk about getting, you know, down. And don't think for a minute that the devil in such times doesn't absolutely enjoy watching us sink. You know, I had a lousy night's sleep last night. It's you know, July, what are we, 17th? Yeah, maybe it's because of the winter storm that went through. I don't know exactly, you know. But honestly, I had a lousy night's sleep. And woke up twice. And the second time I woke up, guess what was on my mind? Thoughts that just beating me down. Discouragement. You know, I thought, wow. I didn't prepare my sermon, by the way, this morning. Right? But God, it's like God was saying, here, I'm going to give this to you. You know, this is not academic. This is actual. This is real. And we're reading about David beaten down by discouragement and the devil taking delight in that. I read some lore recently, and I think it offers insight. It was advertised that the devil was going to put his tools up for sale. On the date of the sale, the tools were placed for public inspection, each being marked with its sale price. They were a treacherous lot of implements: hatred, envy, jealousy, deceit, lying, pride, and so on. Laid apart from the rest was a harmless-looking tool, well-worn and very pricey. "The name of this tool?" asked one of the purchasers. "Oh," said the adversary, that's discouragement." "Why have you priced it so high?" came the next question. "Because it's more useful to me than all of the others. I can pry open and get inside a person's heart with that when I cannot get near him with my other tools. Now, once I get inside, I can make him do what I choose. It's a badly worn tool because I use it on almost everyone, since very few people know that it belongs to me." Where do you go for courage? Because guess what? Discouragement is not God's deal. I don't know if you put a label on that, but if it helps you connect it, discouragement starts with a D and so does devil. He wants to discourage. Because discouragement will lead to something. You know what it leads to? You tell me. Somebody? Yeah. Doubt? It's very good. And we'll get to that in just a sec. Sin? Self-pity? I'm sorry?
Fear.
Anger? Fear? Yeah, that's probably the most redemptive possibility of all that's been said, reaching out for help. One thing it will do if it's not challenged: defeat. Takes you out of the game. That's not God's plan either. So when we feel outnumbered by our enemies, we can be like David, quickly discouraged, and the devil smiles. So what to do? What did David do? Let's read on. Verse 3. "But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head." You see? He's down. Right? That's discouraged. "You lift up my head. To the Lord I cried aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill, Selah." Think about that, is what is being said. You're a shield around me. Here's the second point. David faced his foes and their taunts by holding tightly to the truth he knew about God. That's what verses 3 and 4 are saying. He faced his foes, and there were many, verses 1 and 2 tell us, and their taunts, and we see one of the many taunts: "God will not deliver you," verse 2. He faced his foes and he faced their taunts by holding on tightly to what he knew about God. What did he know? Verse 3, "You are a shield around me." It's a favorite image of David's, by the way. It was a shield is a defensive weapon. He's not talking here about a piece of armament. That's not what he's talking about. You know what he's talking about? A person. God. See? Not "you give me a shield." "You provide me shielding." "You are a shield around me." That's a deep understanding It's a picture of protection. You are this shield, God. And you're around me. You surround me. Though his outlook was crestfallen, we read the Lord lifts up his head when he's downtrod and downcast. Notice where David turned to verse 4, where he turned in trouble. He turned to the Lord. I cried out to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. He turned to the Lord and cried, and God answered. There's some wonderful verbiage here in the Hebrew in verse 4 that's worth pointing out. The verbs in verse 4 suggest that this is a pattern that David repeated. Let me word it that way. To the Lord, I continued to cry aloud. I cried, and I cried some more, and I cried. But in between my cries came the second half of verse 4, and he answered me from his holy hill. It goes like this. To the Lord, I kept crying, and from the Lord, he kept answering. I kept crying, he kept answering. I cried some more, he answered some more. It's that continuous verb that's being described here. It's not just I cried once, that wrapped it up. No, I cried, and he answered. And I cried some more, and he answered some more. So whenever I face opposition and fearful situations, hatred, I call, I cry on God. And whenever I cry on God, he comes through. Some of you know this so well. Let me ask it as a kind of a broad question. Is that what you do? Instinctively, when you're crestfallen, when your head is down, when your heart is heavy? I think, according to what we're reading, it should be. That should be the direction we go. It was David's direction when he was hunted and hated. And it delivered results. Look at this incredible list of results, verse 5. I lie down and sleep. I awake again. This is right after we've been told, pause, take it in. He cried out, God answered. And I then lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. Selah. Wow. There's a lot of gain. Here's my point. David found great gain, many, multiple gains as a result of turning to God in his troubles. The implication's clear. That happens for us too. Well, let's break it down. Verse 5 to 8, there's several gains that came to David by crying out to God, by turning to him as the deliverer. What are some of those gains? David found calm immediately, verse 5. That's the first word that hits me. Okay? Remember verse 1 and 2? Many are saying, many are my foes. Many have risen up. Many are saying, you're on your own, dude. You're hosed. Many. And in a few short verses later, what do you read in verse 5? A transformed David. I lie down and I sleep. You don't sleep unless, in those circumstances, being hunted, you don't sleep unless God is doing something cool. God's doing something in you. He says, I awake because the Lord sustains me. There's a picture of calm. He could sleep. There's peace and rest, verse 5 tells us. That's what David did. God is watching over me. Yeah, my enemies, they're still there. There are lots of them, and they're saying some very hard things. But you're giving me calm. Here's the second gain. Verse 6, David found courage. What this talk is all about this morning. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. he could stand up to great opposition. He could look at the threat, huge threat, hemmed in, he says, all around me. Where I look, there's no escape route. But he found courage in the midst of a very fearful situation. So calm and courage, and then kind of a cool tone takes over in verse 7. It's conviction, isn't it? It's conviction. He could call on God and say, God, I want you to bring judgment against my enemies. I'm not after revenge. In fact, if you go on to read the story of Absalom, David wept. In fact, he announced, don't harm my son. And then when his son died, it broke his heart. Okay? Remember, the son gunning for him. David wasn't after revenge, but David was after God's judgment against all of those that joined Absalom in this rise up rebellion. So he says in verse 7, arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God, strike all my enemies on the jaw. You are the God of justice implied here. Break the teeth of the wicked God. I don't have to do it, and I would mess it up if I tried. But you can. Do my dirty work. Can I put it in those terms? You do it, God. It's a little hint of a... We used this expression at the start of this sermon and song series. We called them imprecation, where you call on God to bring about judgment. Some sort of a judgment on people. David's doing that here. And he's doing it with conviction. So he has, as a result of crying out to the Lord and God answering, he comes away from that with calm. He comes away with courage, verse 6. He comes away with conviction, verse 7. And then look how verse 8 wraps it up. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. He found confidence. Confidence. He could see the outcome, the victory, because he could see the Lord, his deliverer. I think that's a very impressive list of gains that God gave David when David turned his face to God in the face of a very great personal and national crisis. He was the king. Calm, courage, conviction, confidence. Fact is, most of us have faced hatred. Maybe some, even this morning, you're in that spot. It's a tough spot. From someone or maybe something. And with it comes the loss of confidence. It kind of sucks it out of you. And the result is that fear begins to take its toll. Somebody said that earlier. I think that's what happens. Begin to doubt. You have fear. David's answer, turn to God. Turn to God who will be your shield despite the size of the enemy. Turn to God. A true story is told about the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. No safety devices were used in the early going, and 23 men fell to their deaths. A plan was put in place where it involved the placement of a safety net. For the rest of the project, a large safety net now undergird all the work that was being done on this span across the inlet from the Pacific. From that point forward, it was known that at least 10 men fell into the net, and all were saved. True story. An interesting sidebar, also true to this story, is the fact that once the net was put in place, productivity that was measured constantly, productivity from the entire crew building the bridge increased 25%. It seems men could work and live with freedom when they knew they were safe. Same is true, I think, of our lives. God is the safety net who sustains us even when faced with the threat of a very great enemy. He's the net. He's the shield. He's our deliverer. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. So much in the Bible, the songs that we are reading from God's Word contain more information about the shield. I encourage you. The image of shield is so powerful and so vivid. It's meant for consumption. It's meant for you and me to get, to appreciate that God is that shield to you, to me, about us. I want to ask you right now just to kind of reach in this brief time to respond. Reach into your struggle. Think about the things that have you running afraid. As the lights come down, I want you to just remember what we have just now read. A truth. Get this, a truth that transcends. Meaning it doesn't just apply to David. This is not a history lesson. It's meant for you and me. Do you cry? And when you do you feel God move? And you know what? Let's be honest. That's not always the first time you cry. But you keep crying. Sometimes for long seasons you cry. The answers. He's a shield about us. He is. So just respond in this simple chorus, shield about me.